The past is a very long time. As I write these words in April 2025, Londoners up in Enfield, after having not noticed the destruction of an old oak tree in White Webb's Park, are now getting more and more furious about its mutilation. There seems to be a growing upset that North Londoners lost a mighty oak that was between around 300 to 500 years old. It was a link to our past, to the times that were. Oddly enough, when that tree was planted, Enfield wasn't part of London. London was a much smaller affair, and even if we assume it was 500 years old, what strikes me is that in our grand narrative of the city, we are still back beyond its planting date. Our story is currently set in the year 1410, 615 years ago, much older than that tree. Indeed, the single oldest oak tree in London, the Fulham Palace Oak, we think dates to 1495, which is 70 years ahead of where we are in the story. The history of London is long, after all. Still, if you wish to find a tree that was around during the events of this chapter, and is still around today, you need to go to Barnet. The Totteridge Yew stands in the churchyard of St Andrews. This is an ancient site of Christian worship. Supposedly, there was a church dedicated to St. Ethelreda, dating all the way back to the year 603 of the Common Era on this site. But as times passed, St. Ethelreda faded out for St. Andrew. The great yew tree on that site is said to be at least 1,000 years old, maybe as much as 2,000 years. Can you imagine that? A tree that has borne witness to all these events. All the events of London. It's one of the reasons I go into so much detail about London's past. To allow us both appreciate the passing of the time, but to give context to those previous Londoners. Their passions are very much as real as our passions. They had their own versions of the Enfield Oak. Things they would get upset about. They lived their lives filled with events and people and things. The purpose of this podcast is to simply try to give justice to them and their history. We have reached the 146th chapter of the story, covering a few years where London was coping with antisocial behaviour, the impact of long-term economic contractions, where a new militant Englishness was being born, and where the royal family seriously got its act together. This is the secret regime. Welcome to London. In the winter of 1410, the city was gripped in a freezing whiteout that lasted over 3 months, they say. A bitterly cold and brutal time. But what was London like to live in during the next few years? It was a place that was in decline, that was for sure. As we enter the second decade of the 15th century, there is a noticeable decrease in the population. We see the numbers of people living in Cheapside drop, but it's an effect we see replicated as far south as Southwark and as far west as Westminster. Population levels drop to numbers not seen in the previous 100 years. But it was not just the impact of plague doing this. London had in previous centuries suffered several outbreaks of the plague, and seen many thousands of its residents die, but the numbers quickly rebounded back. But around now, due to the miasma of ongoing economic crisis, the numbers were not. The city was cold and it was suffering from the effects of a lack of coin in England. The numbers of newcomers migrating to London was dropping. And at the same time, there was increased flight from the city. During these years, you see a spike in the numbers of bankruptcies appearing in London's court. The most high profile was a case in 1414, where we saw three prominent mercers actually appeal to Parliament because of monies owed to them by the high profile grocer William Venner the Younger. Venner was a 10-year veteran of the Aldermanic Council and a giant in London's political scene, but it appeared that the grocer had fallen on hard times. In the face of over £400 worth of debts, he had sold his belongings and placed his assets in other men's names. The allegation was that he was living off the earnings of these in secret, having escaped abroad to avoid his debts. But his case was not isolated. We see records of other merchants and respectable Londoners joining the list of those crippled with debt. Men like John Brandon, Thomas Boss and Alan Hull were forced to leave the city due to their financial difficulties. Men like John Turver and John Sutton were forced to give up their shops and to abandon their apprentices for the same reasons. And others such as Peter Kirby and William Hanwell managed to stay afloat, but only by mortgaging everything. These were harsh times. To those who remained in London, how does one cope? How does a people reconcile their stress in such conditions? How did London react to these things? Well, it's interesting because we get some gentle insights into the nature of London's social life during these few years, what they were up to in order to help them unwind. In 1409, for example, the mayor of London, an ironmonger called Richard Marlowe, wrote a play called The Creation of the World, which we think was a mummer's play based on the stories in the book of Genesis. This play was staged over 8 days in 1409 and was performed by the company of parish clerks near the Skinner's Well up in Clerkenwell. So even if there are no physical theatres around at this point, and we're quite a few centuries away from there being theatres, Londoners showed even back then they liked a good play. They also liked the practice of hawking. What was hawking? Well, it seemed to have started as a manifestation of a religious festival, and it became a source of antisocial behaviour. The Hawktide, or the Hawk Days, were the first Monday and Tuesday after Easter, and they were seen as a cause for celebration in the medieval period. The idea is that during the Hawktide, and especially on the Tuesday, there was a chance for women of the parishes around England to raise some money for the local church. Across England, in a score of villages and local parishes, women would capture and tie up local men and release them in exchange for a small fee, which would then be donated to the church. However, within London, these things seem to have gotten a bit out of control. While Hawk Tuesday was still pronounced, on the Monday before, we saw groups of young men hang around the narrow alleyways and quiet lanes of the city, and if they spotted an attractive female, they'd basically throw a rope around her, bind her, drag them to her, and then offer to release her for a penny for the poor, or a kiss, or both. Yes, it does sound a little bit rapey and a little bit creepy, but the raucousness does seem to have been replicated the following day by the young women of London also. And this, in turn, led to the mayor issuing the following decree. Quote, "Let proclamation be made that no person within the city of London, or in the suburbs thereof, of whatsoever estate or condition such a person may be, whether man or woman, shall, in any street or lane thereof, take hold of or constrain any person of whatever estate or condition he may be, within house or without, for hawking on the Monday and Tuesday next, called the Hawking Days," unquote. What I find interesting is that tiny line in that forbidding hawking both within house and without, suggesting hawking was taking place behind closed doors, or it was feared it was doing so. This was actually London's second anti-hawking ordinance in 10 years. And it does seem to reflect a change in attitudes towards the ritual. Given that it may have already been long established tradition in the country by then, this sudden condemnation and banning stands out. Was it caused by the Aldermanic administration being prudish? Or had the harsh conditions made people more lively when it came to things like this? We will never know. But it is worth seeing that in the last few years of the rule of Henry IV, this wasn't the only street entertainment being banned. We also read, quote, that no man or child, of what estate or condition he may be so hardy to wrestle or to make any wrestling within the sanctuary of the bounds of Paul's, nor in any other open place in the city of London, upon pain of imprisonment for 40 days, unquote. Ah, street wrestling was still a thing. It was all the way back in chapter 87 of the story, The Lamentable Death of Constantine FitzAlnuf, that I first mentioned the rather passionate support London had for wrestling back in the 1200s, and it's still clearly ongoing. Here it does seem that St. Paul's Churchyard was being used overtly as a location for wrestling matches. I mean, it's nice and central for everyone to turn up, right? But the punishment of 40 days in jail does suggest that Londoners were taking it too far and the authorities were getting annoyed. But the decline in London during this era did not see people just seeking escapism. The people began to change. And it's about now that two social trends that had been growing in London in the years before begin to start being noticed and need to be mentioned going forward. The first was a change in the city's attitude and relationship with literacy. London was beginning to understand that education was becoming increasingly important to be able to access certain jobs. The grocers, the mercers, other crafts had always required literacy and ciphering in their apprentices, and probably at least some knowledge of Latin. Indeed, as far back as 1402, we see a Yorkshire knight bequeath £20 to a boy with instructions that he was to be taught to read and write, and then, when he had those skills, he should be sent to London to learn the craft of either the fishmongers or the grocers or the mercers. So even the fishmongers were requiring literate apprentices. And even a profession as homespun as brewers, we find many in this era could read and write in English, even if they were not usually expected to know French or Latin. It's been estimated by various historians that roughly about 30% of the population of England in the 15th century could read and write. But from this era on, we begin to notice that the proportion of the population of London who was literate was always higher than in the rest of the country. London, around now, starts becoming noticeable as a city where literacy was required to access many jobs. And this theme of London having a higher literacy rate than the rest of England is to be the norm going forward for some centuries. It's to be expected, though. The born and raised residents of the city had grown up in a place where, as far back as the 12th century, their sons could go to learn French and Latin in a series of long-established and respectable grammar schools. But there is a sense that this higher-than-average literacy in London now begins to start showing some unexpected side effects. For example, increased learning in the parishioners of London's churches meant a growing number who required a higher degree of learning from their clergy. The demands upon London's clerics now began to change, and as such, a more educated class of clergy began appearing across the city. And this could explain away why we are seeing London become known as a hotbed for the Lollards, the clerics involved in church reform. Right now, London was becoming a national centre for them. But beyond that, if you raise educational standards, or the population has raised educational standards, what you also see is that they raise their expectations and their hopes. You start finding a people who begin to wish for better things for themselves, for their children, for their community. And so London, even here in the cold of the 1410s, despite this terrible recession and economic difficulties, has aldermen displaying such aspirations as they decide to rebuild the Guildhall. Someone at the time dismissively called it an, quote, old and little cottage, unquote, and either its modest size did not reflect the importance the aldermen placed on their city, or it was simply in a state of disrepair. So around 1410, it was decided to rebuild the Guildhall under the direction of the master mason John Croxton. It would take about 2 decades or so to complete. And it is this version of the Guildhall that survived the tumults of London to come, including the Great Fire and, of course, the Blitz. We know part of the stone undercroft of the original little cottage was retained in the Croxdale rebuild. Elements like the porch do survive from this rebuild, though its facade was rebuilt 300 years later. And we know leading members of the community contributed towards the new civic hall. The floor was paved by Purbeck marble at the expense of the estate of Richard Whittington, who also, along with others, paid for various stained windows and statues. The principal feature of this new Guildhall, however, was its size. The Guildhall was to reflect how Londoners saw themselves, and it was rebuilt to be the second largest hall in all of England, measuring 152 feet long and just shy of 50 feet wide. The only place in the kingdom that was bigger was Westminster Hall, the Great Hall of the Kings of England. Around 1411, the civic administration of Mayors Thomas Knowles and his fellow grocer, Mayor Richard Chikeley, not only began rebuilding the Guildhall, the City Fathers acquired Leadenhall, the mansion that had been used as a market, principally for selling butter, poultry, cheese. John Croxton, though busy on the new Guildhall, was engaged here on additional works and improvements to the building, and Leadenhall Market, still specialising in poultry, is owned by the city to this day. Yet these aspirational actions by London's aldermen must be contrasted to other big social change taking place in London at this time, another unexpected political side effect of London's economic crisis. We begin to see from now on, for the next few decades or so, a noticeable lack of competition in the numbers of people running for positions such as alderman, sheriff or mayor. Why? Was simple to understand. The whole merchant class of London was suffering from this recession, and it became clear that many feared taking on the expensive and rather onerous duties of becoming sheriff or mayor. The draper, John Gedley, for example, actually refused to become an alderman when he was elected to the post in 1415. He finally agreed after they imprisoned him. In 1414, we see a sickly and infirm city officer called John Proffitt being implored to stay in his post for just another year, as they couldn't find anybody to replace him. Increasingly, we see the same names reappear in public offices. And it has to be said, it's not because they were especially popular or because they were especially powerful. It's because others were unable or unwilling to shoulder the burden of leading London. Indeed, so bad did this evasion of taking on board civic duty become that in just a few years' time, around 1416 or so, the city ended up passing an ordinance forbidding anyone from conspiring to avoid serving as mayor or sheriff. And because of this, another side effect was that across London you were seeing in the livery companies a split between those who made it to aldermanic levels of wealth and those members who found they simply could not. Social advancement was being stymied, and aldermanic guild members began exerting increasing power over the livery companies going forward. But with this loss of social mobility, which was always in its own way one of the promises London made to its citizens, you begin to see people seeking who was to blame for this. I mean, sure, the easiest way was to blame the mayor or the government, but London was a leading market of the country and they witnessed the endless efforts by the Crown to mitigate the issues, and the city understood that their problems did not stem from England. There was a sense that the principal competition and the cause of London's problems in this era came from Europe. That while there were regional markets and cities around England whose rise could eat into London's profitability as a community, Londoners understood it was the impact of foreigners from outside the nation who threatened the livelihood of the larger merchants of the city and trickling down the entire community. Now, it has to be said, no single factor explained away the economic crisis England was facing. You had haphazard taxation policy of numerous kings, but to that must be added a shortage in money supply, and you had contractions of foreign markets taking place. And then add to this inclement weather and terrible disease. All these things played a part. But even with these all involved, it's hard not to be struck by the obvious correlation between a massive slump or a boom and war and truce. The never-ending war with the French was crippling England. And yet, because of this, the kings needed foreign money to cover the shortfalls in the English economy, and to gain that, they would grant concessions to foreigners. And this situation had been the same as it had been for many years. But we do get a sense that the underlying prevailing hostility towards foreigners began manifesting itself increasingly in this era. And not just as a hatred of foreigners, but if a people are developing a sense of a them and us mentality, the key thing is to be sure what us means. An example. In 1411, a petition was presented to Parliament from the loyal subjects of King Henry IV, who happened to have been born and raised in Gascony. Many of these had been driven out of their homeland by the ongoing conflict with the French and ultimately forced to resettle in England. Some had married English women. Others had brought property and established businesses here. And they were all loyal to the king. But the English continued to call them aliens, quote, and many other undesirable names, unquote. Having literally nowhere else to go, they begged the king to have their loyalty publicly proclaimed in towns and elsewhere, and to be able to live and work, quote, as fully as your other legions born in your said realm of England, unquote. Henry IV granted their request and ordered letters patent to be issued to them. But this did not make them English, not to the English. And compared to, say, the state of the Welsh, the Irish and the Scots, these Gascons were getting off lightly. For years, even the residents of the British Isles were treated as second-class citizens. They were seen as barbarians, attitudes enshrined in legislation. I mean, under the law of the land, a Welshman was forbidden from purchasing property, carrying weapons, or even enjoying the privileges of citizenship of a town or a city, while Welsh and Scottish tenants wishing to remain in England had to provide sureties for good behaviour and swear allegiance to the crown. The sense of us against them was real. And this is an era where a powerful new sense of us, of Englishness, was coming to the fore. Something we would see become more visceral than we had seen previously. London had always been proud of the nation, but in this era we see a new hardening of identity. Not since Alfred the Great had forged the Anglesin out of the survivors of Wessex and Mercia had we seen such a sense of identity with nation and race, for want of a better word, begin to manifest itself so harshly. And of course, there were foreigners themselves in London reinforcing this them and us mentality. London was the home of many expatriates. Even with the bloodbath and massacre of the Flemish residents, which took place during the Peasants' Revolt, which we covered back in chapter 134, we know foreigners and richer ones at that resided within London. The Hanse merchants of the steelyards, the Germans who for good or for bad had remained in the city through this time, always hovered at about 30 or so, give or take, while the number of Lombards or Italians was about double that. Yet, despite their small numbers, these belied their massive commercial power and their share of the imports and exports of cloth and spices and commodities from the North Sea and the Mediterranean made them have a significant impact on the psyche of London. It was like a constant spur to the Londoners going forward. They are them, and this is us. And all of these things have reflected how London was coping and changing in the face of an overwhelming economic crisis. But if this was London, how went the rest of the nation? How was England coping with this heavy weight? Well, we actually see something completely unprecedented. Within the reign of Henry IV, the king's three eldest sons were now emerging as prominent figures. Henry IV had a large family, and in 1410, they were beginning to make an impact on the political scene. He had four sons: Henry, aged 24, Prince of Wales; Thomas, aged 23, Duke of Clarence; John, aged 21, Duke of Bedford; and Humphrey, aged 20, Duke of Gloucester. He also had two daughters. Blanche had died a year earlier, was only aged 17, and Philippa, who was 16, who was married to the King of Sweden, Denmark, and Norway. Fortunately for King Henry, By the time his health had begun to go into serious decline, his three eldest boys, Thomas, John, and Henry, had actually had several years of military experience behind them. Not just fighting and leading troops, but understanding the financial responsibilities that came with organizing large armies. This understanding of the logistics of state was to be their most important lesson. Henry IV had been no absent father to his sons. They were, after all, not born princes. They were royal cousins, but they weren't due to inherit the throne. When the boys were children, he had fairly diligently educated them, providing them with personal tutors and ensuring they received a comprehensive education in Latin, music, sword skills, and leadership. And once he ascended to the throne, he did make an effort to spend time with them, to not be estranged from his sons like Henry II had been estranged from his mighty brood of princes. And so it was, due to the nature of their father's regime, they had barely reached adolescence when significant political responsibilities had been thrust upon them. At the incredibly young age of 13, Henry was appointed Prince of Wales. Thomas had been made Lieutenant of Ireland at 14, and John was appointed Warden of the East March at the same age. In fulfilling these posts as effectively viceroys of the king, the young princes, well, it became a way of testing their suitability for rulership and gave them valuable on-the-job training about the realities of running this country. And while they could and did disagree with one another over many things, they would write to each other using terms such as, quote, our dearest brother, unquote. After 1406, and particularly after 1408, Henry's kingship gradually transitioned into a form of Lancasterian family government. The dynasty was in charge. Like a mob family, the sons were stepping up to help their father rule this fractious land. The princes were very different young men, personality-wise. I mean, they said Thomas was blunt and restless, the kind of man who would hold a grudge and was easy to provoke, although he was very loyal to his friends. John was the family peacemaker, sensible, dutiful, hard-working. Young Humphrey was the smart one, the most bookish of the brothers. But ahead of them all, the eldest and the dynamo, Henry. And certainly, from 1409, he began to have a growing influence on national affairs. The principal issue facing England, as we said, is this crippling economic crisis hitting the country right now. And this had a series of big knock-on ramifications. One of which took place back in the Christmas of 1406. The strategically crucial garrison of Calais found themselves so in arrears of payment that the soldiers seized all the wool in the town's warehouses with the intention of selling it to anyone for a quick return. The town's treasurer, who was supposed to cover the fees, was a man called Robert Thorney, who was in debt to the tune of £30,000. In time, this was resolved. And the person who resolved it was the London merchant, mayor, ironmonger, and future playwright, Richard Marlowe, who became the treasurer of Calais. Of course, the solution to a problem in Calais came from London. London depended upon Calais, and so London's aldermen and merchants helped Marlowe arrange for the state to cover much of the owed monies, with about £19,500 physically shipped across the Channel during the next few months. But the almost mutiny of Calais made an impact on things and was indicative of an economic crisis that was crippling the political situation. And the political situation of endless war made the economic situation worse. Between Easter 1409 and Easter 1410, there was an increased resort to borrowing by the crown, mainly from the Londoners. But Henry IV's ministers were increasingly trying to reduce their expenditure. In November 1409, there was an attempt made to reduce the expenditure of the royal household or the wardrobe to just £13,333. But even these modest means were hard-pressed to be raised, and almost a third of it actually had to be borrowed directly from the merchants of the City of London. But in the same month, and as part of the same spirit of reform, it was decided to cut the proportion of the wool subsidy reserved for Calais in half. And this triggered Prince Henry. The fears that this would cause another mutiny saw that the young prince become the self-appointed champion of the Calais garrison. Maintaining its funds became the cause he drew a line in the sand in. And as such, he was willing to confront his sickly father and his trusted advisors over this. And the result was several weeks of intense behind-the-scenes rows. A meeting of the Royal Council at Westminster that followed saw arguments and disagreements we can only guess at, but we can see their effects. By December the 11th, 1409, the head of the Treasury of England resigned. And then by the 21st, the Chancellor of England, the Bishop of Arundel, also quit his post. And there was a brief period of a gap, a miasma, where neither of these two crucial positions were filled. All the signs suggest that over that Christmas, there were backroom negotiations between father and son. King Henry IV and Prince Henry, Prince of Wales, were jostling about the future direction of the country. Another example of this? Well, Parliament had already been summoned that year, but it was supposed to meet in Bristol, possibly because, well, it was felt that if they met in Westminster, the merchants of London, and who had this role now currently as financiers to the Crown, could have had undue influence over the proceedings of that Parliament. But on December 18th in 1409, right in the middle of these discussions between king and son, the Bristol location was scrapped and Parliament was ordered to meet in Westminster. These things do suggest that there was a power struggle being played out for control over the resources of the Crown and, more than that, actual executive power. And the first hint of a resolution appeared on the 6th of January 1410. Lord Scrope of Masham, a supporter of young Prince Henry, was appointed the royal treasurer. And by the end of January 1410, we see another of his supporters, Thomas Buford, made Chancellor of England. And this sent out a clear signal to anyone paying attention at the time. Henry IV was King of England, but Henry, Prince of Wales, was the man in the driving seat. The young prince had gained control over direction of the state. Going forward, this new shadow regime within a regime, the eldest son and his brothers maintaining stability by effectively taking control of the state from their ailing father, is somewhat at odds with the images of Prince Hal from Shakespeare's plays, but it's actually more in keeping with the man himself. But this new shadow regime of Prince Henry was immediately hit with a new wave of problems, and the biggest of these was France. And in this, I now have to say that while England was being, well, hit by crippling economic issues and a very tough political situation, this was child's play to what was going on right now across the Channel. France was entering a seriously interesting time. And what's happening in France was important to know because, you know, England was still at war with France. This never-ending war with the French. Well, for the last 14 years, this never-ending war had actually been a mixture of serious peace and serious outbreaks of war. Technically, the 30-year truce of 1396 was in place. But this meant the truce had to be supplemented by ongoing local truces, most of which only lasted a few months at a time, which meant there's a constant wave of negotiations taking place all over the place, endlessly. Now, it was hoped round about 1406, that a longer-term peace deal was possible. And this was because the French government was falling into fractions because the French king, Charles IV, was becoming increasingly enfeebled. The principal noble who managed to place himself in charge was a man called John of Burgundy. Burgundy was the Count of Flanders, and he needed peaceful relations with England so Flanders could benefit from the English cloth exports that flowed through London. And as such, as he gained more influence, so the prospect of peace increased. Seriously, peace was on the cards. In 1407, the English seriously proposed that Prince Henry should be betrothed to Charles IV's daughter, Marie. Princess Marie, however, had entered a convent at age 4 and had no desire to jump over the wall and get hitched to some English heir to the throne. But while that idea was scuppered, there was a hope that peace was indeed possible. But of course, John of Burgundy had a rival. the Duke of Orleans, the king's brother. By 1407, he'd been trying to wreck any kind of peace with England. Not because he was especially hostile towards England, it appears. After all, he and Henry IV had agreed to support each other back when Henry was in exile in France, but simply because the Duc d'Orléans utterly hated John of Burgundy, and vice versa. War with England would completely screw Burgundy's revenues. So he was pushing for increased intolerance of English demands in the various talks going on, while also trying to block any payments to Burgundy from the French treasury. Finally, the Duke of Burgundy snapped. And on the evening of the 23rd of November 1407, things came to a rather nasty head. Duke Louis of Orléans paid a visit to Queen Isabeau of France. She was in her palace, close to the Porte Babette in Paris. The Duke of Orléans, King, came to offer her his respects while he was there. A messenger suddenly appeared and informed the Duke that the King wished to see him urgently. Instantly, the Duke obeyed the summons and stepped out of the palace. The moment he was outside, he was attacked by around 20 men. In panic, he cried, "I am the Duke d'Orléans!" before hearing the ominous words, "That's exactly who we're looking for!" What followed was brutal. They stabbed him repeatedly, multiple times, smashed his skull like an eggshell, chopped off his left hand, and then dragged his corpse to a nearby rubbish and latrine pit and dumped it there. It was only 48 hours after this that the Duke of Burgundy, in the face of mass uproar, confessed that he had indeed hired the assassins. And then he fled to Flanders for his safety. 3 months later, however, in March 1408, he returned to Paris, bold as brass, and presented a long-winded explanation for his actions. The bewildered and rather confused Charles IV actually gave him a pardon. This caused a totally different type of uproar, and Duke Louis of Orléans' widow, Duchess Valentina, and his son, the new Duke Charles, now wished bloody revenge upon Burgundy. Of course, it didn't help their mood that in Paris, while there'd been noble outrage at the death of the Duke of Orléans, many of the Parisians were delighted at the grisly fate met by that git. And this was the start of one hell of a blood feud that would tear apart the French royal family and which was to impact upon Anglo-French relations going forward. The King of France was simply unable to cope. By July 1408, he revoked the pardon he'd given to the Duke of Burgundy, bowing to pressure, and then a few months later, bowing to totally different pressure, he restored it again. By 1409, the Duke of Burgundy and the 14-year-old very angry Charles of Orléans underwent a public reconciliation in Chartres' Cathedral. But while the King and Queen seemed to be pleased they've restored peace, the end result was that the control of the French government and control of the French King now fell into the hands of the Duke of Burgundy. Within a few weeks, negotiations began with Burgundy regime to discuss terms for a, quote, true final peace, unquote. Anglo-French relations seemed to improve rapidly. The local truces in Brittany and Flanders were periodically renewed through 1408, and piracy on the Channel dropped, and an 18-month general truce was introduced, and there was talk of cementing the peace deal by a series of dynastic marriages, including, in 1409, the very serious proposal that Prince Henry should marry the French king's youngest daughter, Catherine. But, for various reasons that would take another hour to give any justice to their explanation, Burgundy couldn't just establish peace with England. I mean, there was a matter of French pride here, and the French really wanted Calais back, like really, really, and the English were certainly not giving it. And so despite all this, despite Burgundy wanting peace, you know, he was still prepared to fight to give him favourable terms here. This is why you have events like the Anglo-Burgundian joust held at Smithfield, just north of London in July 1409, and a few months later with a sister joust held over in Lille. These events were probably cover to allow clandestine diplomatic relations with representatives of the Duke of Burgundy take place. But, regardless of how close peace seemed, by early 1410 there was a growing conviction in both England and France that Calais was about to be attacked. In January 1410, the soon-to-be Chancellor Henry Beaufort opened Parliament with a warning that war was about to fall on Calais, and he found a receptive audience of the Commons. It was by now common knowledge that in Paris. The month before, the king had held a council and a list of vexations caused to the French by the regime of Henry IV had been discussed. The renewal of war seemed likely, and we now know that the Duke of Burgundy was actually preparing an assault. But two things stopped that from happening. The first was in April 1410, where an event took place in the French town of Saint-Omer. Here they were constructing a, quote, enormous wooden tower, unquote, in the churchyard there. And that was going to act as the central siege platform from which they would attack Calais. An English prisoner of the French who was in the town offered a considerable sum of money to a local carpenter to pour Greek fire upon the giant structure, destroying it and undoing months of hard work. And then at the same time, around about April 15th, 1410, a new coalition of French nobles, the Dukes d'Orléans, Berry and Brittany, together with the Counts of Alarcon, Clermont and Angmarac, formed a new cabal, swearing to rid France of those who acted contrary to, quote, the welfare and honour of the king and the kingdom, unquote. Of course, they're talking about the Duke of Burgundy and his supporters. A civil war was on. Both sides now started summoning their loyalists, who summoned their men, and armies now began to focus on anyone except the English. Prince Henry was holding on to the reins of power in the state, and he did so up until around autumn of 1411. And then in how to deal with this situation in France, his father reasserted his kingship in order to get some control over the government and direction of foreign policy. It's interesting, however, that he did this as his health was seriously declining. By the early part of 1412, he could no longer walk or ride without being in pain, and he was, by all accounts, horribly disfigured. This incapacity, this pain he gained from travelling, saw his itinerary shrink. In May 1411, we know he was in Gloucester, but after that, with the exception of a single trip to Canterbury, he spent the rest of his life in and around London, with Windsor Castle being as far west as he went. In reality, this highly travelled king was reduced to visiting Lambeth Palace, Merton Priory, Croydon and Mortlake. He seemed to be filled with regret and penitence. Word came that he wished to travel and end his days in Jerusalem. Henry IV regaining his power was, as we said, predicated on his disagreement with his son's Henry direction in the sudden change of the war in France. And here we see the old king's officials retake back their old posts after the brief shadow regime of his son's supporters. And we see the Duke of Clarence landing an army in the south of France. What the prince did there is often overlooked by historians, but in short, this campaign was hideously expensive, but ultimately successful, and meant that in a few years' time, when his older brother went to invade France, he could invade northern France because of what his brother had done in southern France. But the shadow regime, the year around it, is one filled with strange moments that don't seem to make sense. There was a tale of someone trying to assassinate Prince Henry about now. He travelled to London, where he was joined and met by huge numbers of people, suggesting he was popular. But he then went on to go see his father, and in the Green Chamber of Westminster Palace, a spaniel sniffed out a man hiding behind a hanging in the room where the prince was staying. Interrogated by the Earl of Arundel, the intruder claimed he wished to kill the prince and ended up being tied in the sack and cast into the Thames. We know Prince Henry was being accused of misappropriating the funds of Calais. He was cleared, but he showed there was somewhat of a backlash being directed towards him. There was politics going on. On December 1st, 1412, writs were issued for a meeting of Parliament at Westminster on the 3rd of February the following year. Shortly before Christmas, the king fell gravely ill again, although he recovered enough to celebrate Christmas at Eltham, quote, with as much joy as he could summon, unquote. We know he spent the next month being moved between Greenwich, Mortlake and Lambeth before returning to Westminster by early February. He spent the last 6 weeks of his life rousing himself only to address Parliament, but then fading. By now, one source says he was, quote, all sinews and bones, unquote. Another said the king was, quote, cruelly tormented by festering of flesh, dehydration of the eyes, and rupture of the internal organs, unquote. Others said his body was, quote, completely shrunken and wasted by disease, unquote. The king went to make an offering at the tomb of Edward the Confessor in Westminster Abbey on the 20th of March. Here he collapsed and was taken to the nearby Jerusalem chamber in the abbot's lodging, placed in front of the fire. The story goes when he came to and discovered the name of this room was Jerusalem, he felt his promise to die there could be fulfilled, and thus he passed. His body was wrapped 5 times round in leather and sealed in a leaden shroud before being placed in an elmwood coffin and carried down the Thames to Gravesend, from where he was then conveyed to Canterbury to be laid to rest in the cathedral there. Henry V was crowned at Westminster Abbey on the 9th of April. The ceremony was marked by a very bad snowstorm, but people were unable to decide if this was a good omen or a bad one. The shadow regime was over. This new young king was crowned. And with this, we see a change. A new start. A new king. One who had clearly been preparing for this very role. Henry V intended to start his reign running. Not for him, his father's problems. Henry IV had never been born to take the throne. He was the son of John of Gaunt. And while wildly travelled and a dynamo in his own right, even during his rebellion against Richard II, he'd never intended to, you know, run England. But then he'd had to. And the weight of the problems he faced seemed to break him physically. He was never able to get to grips with them. But as the snow billowed through London's streets that April 1413, and Henry V, scarred and war-marked, made his way to Westminster, surrounded by the crowds of Londoners, there was a hope that this coronation was to start a new age. And in many ways, it did. Great glory was coming, and better weather lay ahead. And I'm going to leave it there. Thanks for listening. I'm terribly sorry we were delayed this week. That's due to unexpected real-life issues. Normal service will resume next week. This is Saul saying, hope you have a good week. Hope the weather's not too bad for you. And I'll see you then. Bye.